This is Off Planet Radio.
Beginning here. This is Off Planet Radio. I'm Randy Moggins, and it is July 4th, 2012, and I'm on the line with somebody who is fairly well known and yet somewhat of an enigma. He cuts a wide footprint in history, and we're going to touch on a little bit about that today. This is an introductory interview that we're doing in preparation for a live show interview that we will be doing on July 18th of 2012. Over our normal regular Wednesday night stream. So having said that, I welcome Bob Neverett on Off Planet Radio. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Randy. Glad to be on your show, or even to be part of the preliminary world.
The preliminary world, that's what it is. This is the pre-show. And I guess, you know, where to begin, maybe the beginning, and just touch a little bit on your background. People who know you and know of you, of course, are aware that you were born in 1922 in Paris, yes. And that you were part of a, I guess we would call it a British enclave. Would that be the correct way to say it? You lived in a British enclave in Paris?
They spoke English because they were international, but they came from all kinds of different bloodlines through many centuries over Europe. And Paris was the capital back then for the international scene, so it was best to be in Paris, and that's where they were. But we spoke English in the home, and I was a family of servants, part of a family of servants for the people.
Now, when you say servants, that's a bit of a, it kind of hides the fact of the level of importance that your family actually did play. Your family goes back over 300 years in that particular line of work, correct?
Yes, yes. You know, have you seen the TV show series Downton Abbey?
I absolutely have. It was you who turned me on to it, and I became morbidly addicted to it.
Has it started up again? I don't think it has yet.
The second series has already aired in the UK, but I don't think it's dropped in the U.S. Thanks to the miracle of BitTorrent, I've actually been able to see that season. So now I'm disclosing something, but yeah.
But you've seen the part of after World War One.
Yes.
Because that's my fate. I mean, that's my past. You know the dumb kid, the one who goes to war, and what, he gets shot?
I think he was Irish. Yeah. He was one of the house servants, right?
Yeah, and he was in love with the quiet girl who didn't really want, was forced into marrying him.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's me. I mean, you know, just an average kid and trying to get by in the situation there. But I cite that to show what one can do, because I became a lot more aware later as it unfolded.
Your father...
So that's the world we lived in, and it was dying after World War One, which was really interesting. And that's where life got really interesting for my father and I, because my father being the main butler, He'd be like the guy, remember the guy, the serious leader of the butlers, of the servants?
Yes, yes, the head of the household, yeah.
Yeah, that's the way my father was. He was a respectable, you know, sober guy, proud of his family, what they've done in serving those one or two families. And yet things were changing. And he was brought to his work because many of these oligarchies suffered after World War One. They lost a lot. And especially with the collapse of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire and the network that was part of. So my father was brought into levels of working for his master that he'd never been part of. And that's in the 1920s, and that's when he met all these interesting characters that are mentioned in my diary. And then I, you know, happened to be around and meet some of myself, but he was an ascetic. He probably would have been an artist if he wasn't a butler or something. You know, he was an intellectual in his own private interests. And so he got to meet all these people because his employers were interested in what was going on in the world. They hadn't been interested for a couple hundred years. They didn't have to be. They were rather, complacent?
Yeah, they were kind of isolated. Yeah,
isolated, complacent, and everything's going great. Now everything was up for grabs, so they had to start looking around. And they were interested in what new minds were doing, like the scientists around Einstein, the artists around Picasso and Duchamp and that. You'll see that Peggy Guggenheim is over there at that time, in the 20s.
Yes.
You know, many of the American oligarchy kids know something's up, and they want to be on the scene. So James Joyce and Duchamp and these people, they met all kinds of people through all levels of society, and my father was in the mix of that.
Your father, even though we would term him as being a domestic, actually, in a sense, kind of became what we today define as an intelligence officer. He became sort of a liaison between the outside world and the families that you served.
Yeah, you could call it the outreach. Since the oligarchs were getting more nervous in the 20s and 30s, they had to start talking to people. They had to deal with the turnover of political dynasties. You know, the fascists come in, the Nazis, everything's topsy-turvy. And the advantage of the oligarchy, which I call the Priory of Sion, because they are talked about in the 50s and 60s with Pierre Plantard's droppings in the bibliotheque, or wherever he put them in Paris, the things that were found later in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail books. They didn't call themselves a Prior Sion at the time, but they had privy to some of the information that was later attributed to them. So it was a lot of disinformation, a lot of semi-fact, fiction, all mixed up. Part of making oneself their groupie charismatic, because they had to try to create some kind of awe. And so that's part and parcel of the confusion of the time. So my father was... because they had an advantage of, they didn't have to give loans. They didn't loan money. They invested his employers.
Mm-hmm.
They never. Whereas the Rockefellers started to loan money all around the world in the, say, after World War II, and that left them vulnerable in the 70s. But the oligarchies of Europe, at least the ones that I knew about, they just invested. So they're always interested from a comfortable position. I mean, they didn't have to make any more money. They could survive on their interest and all the stuff they had. But they wanted to know what was happening in science and pharmacy and everything that was going on. So my father would go around and meet these people, introduce them, whatever they heard about. And so we actually, with my father, went to Hoffman's lab in 1943. And actually were there the week that he took the acid, even though we didn't know anything that was going to happen.
The famous bicycle ride.
Right. That week, April 19th or 16th, 19th or something, we actually visited that week because there was lots of talk around the Sandoz company about what they were up to, what they were trying to experiment, and my father's employers knew about it. They wanted to see what they could find out. And they always had the charisma that, well, okay, so, Mr. Dobbs, you want to look at our lab and you are interested in investing? Yes, we might want to invest in you. You know what I mean? They had the charisma and the open door of giving some money to the scene, or not lending, but just adding supplements, something that looks, auspicious, that something's going to happen. So I got to meet or be around these fiends, and that's how I met a lot of people. And I didn't fully understand what the hell was going on. You know, I'm just that dumb kid. But in retrospect, I took in a lot of stuff, and it helped later. And then my father was a good guide, too, when things really got crazy after Sputnik went up in 1957. So that's, I could go on for hours about it, but that's where I came from.
Your father sounds in the information that you have up on your timeline on fivebody.com, it sounds like your father had somewhat of a metaphysical background as well. Is that true?
Yes, that's what I meant by him being an artist and intellectual. He was a guy who had to do, he was self-taught, and what I became what's called an autodidact, self-educated. I mean, mm-hmm. he just had a very, very good mind. So because he was able to get out and about in the 20s working for his boss, then he was able to have an excuse to mingle with people that he wanted to mingle, but he couldn't have before World War One, because he had to do his work. I mean, that guy, the head guy, I don't have his name handy, in Downton Abbey, he's running a show there. You know, the guy with the black hair.
Yeah,
and what
yeah.
does he do? He falls in love with, what is he? He gets a problem. He falls in love with someone. Is that what happened in the end of the first year?
You know, I really suck at remembering plot lines.
Yeah, he's sneaking
You get
off.
My wife in here, she'd remember it, but I don't. I look at details.
He's sneaking off. I remember him sneaking off. But anyways, he has, you know, he's taking really a lot of responsibility running the house to make sure everything's perfect. The bow ties are tied. The linen is in the proper place. But that was before World War One. After that, he got out a little more. You know, that old line, you should get out more. Well, he got out.
You know, the reason I ask you that particular question, Bob, is because I'm curious about the role that psychics, clairvoyants, and other type of mystics played in the, I guess you would call it the Victorian world, the world before and maybe a little after World War One. Were the elites at that time making use of psychics and other types of mystical people?
All the time. All the major dynasties, going back to Pharaoh, were people that were ascending in Ion's terms, were getting godlike qualities. They could go to parallel worlds. That's how they got their power. There are parallel world economies. They bring gold over from other worlds. All the big families could do it. I mean, the Rockefellers knew there was a big portal right on Battery Park where the World Trade Center is, that area. And that's what?
Yeah, I'm very aware of that. I lived in New York City at one time, yes.
Yeah, me too. And the point is that is the secret part. It's not that they would dabble with that Ouija board or get some psychic like Rasputin or somebody else. They knew more than the psychics, so to speak, at least the leaders of the family. And that's how they got their power. I mean, they could run a show for 500 years because the locals didn't know.
But these were what we would call today in the common terminology, bloodline families that went back, I guess, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, some of them, not everybody. And it is not wise to say this family went 1,000 years and they go way back because they get toppled. They end up, you know, poverty stricken for a couple hundred years and they get back into the power again. So the continuity, and I have to stress this, the idea of bloodlines is only a particular to certain families that were lucky or continuous for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the ones that had the power lost it, and then they had to get it back and they'd start over. So it is an interesting question, and we've done a lot on the bloodlines in our rewrite course, which was all those that bought the Book of Revelation 23 chapter series, once they'd done that, we were able to be part of this postgraduate thing, which we refer to as the rewrite group. You'll hear Ginny and Greg talk about it on our new cash flow shows, and a few other, Chad and Angela.
Yeah.
We went into that stuff, and Ion told us not to discuss it, you know, outside of the group. So we have to keep that relatively to ourselves at this point. But there is information, and if you ever had a private session with Ion, and when Ion is available again, you can ask these questions.
Yeah.
People, you never know what's going to happen in private session. Ion often doesn't hold back stuff one-on-one, but Ion's careful on the public shows like Cash Flow.
Well, I think part of my questioning line is because I'm sort of a combat-weary veteran right now of the internet streams of information, disinformation, and misinformation that flow around. The whole concept of the bloodlines, to me, has become a wearisome point because it's gotten down to the place where we have people who are vying for, well, I came from this bloodline family and my fam, and it becomes sort of another, I guess you would call it, tarball that's kind of flung at people, and it deflects from some real issues, which is what you just went into, that there's an actual metaphysical aspect to this that most people aren't aware of, that the true power elites in this world have been tapping into something quite amazing for a long time. And I also have the sense that that's where Ion's been going in unveiling what he's been unveiling, both publicly and privately. This whole idea of taking back your power has to do with getting away from that mindset and understanding who we are as individuals.
Yeah, the what I call the chip body, and before that the TV landscape, modern electric media, and this is what James Joyce and the Vorticist artist predicted, it would disrupt all this principality agglutination that bloodlines and other oligarchies had developed. Like I said, they got weakened after World War One. They got even worse after World War Two. They were never brought back in again until the 80s when the Rockefellers went bankrupt on the global level because of, again, computerized economy sped things up beyond chemical body management control. So Prince Charles and the gang came in the 80s, but they eventually got wiped out in the 90s because nobody could deal with the virtual reality, the virtual economy of the Android meme, or the chip economy after 1995. So to focus on chemical body power structures, one of the main messages of me for years and Ion now is it's wide open now because those guys can't, if they regain control, they wouldn't even know what control they had anymore. This is the big news.
You just threaded through a whole bunch of terminology, and I have listeners who are not going to know any of these terms. First off, the idea of the five bodies and then the Android meme, the chemical body, I understand these terms, but maybe you could just give us a real quick thumbnail sketch of what that means.
Okay, so you have the physical body, what people always thought they had, a physical body, what their senses presented them. And most cultures, if not every culture, always felt it was more than what the senses gave you. Mm-hmm. You call it the shamanic, the religious, the spiritual, you know, the wise ones, the elders. They always represented the churches something more than the physical body. So I call that the astral landscape or the astral body, and it's all the literature and the oral traditions and the esoteric stuff, all the stuff that's handed down through the ages. That's a corpus of human expression, human knowledge. So that is parallel to all the knowledge that we develop about our physical body, but I see the physical body as the chemical body because I'm using the knowledge that science acquired starting about 150 years ago when they started to discover, you know, Pasteur germs in the interior landscape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Western science dominates globally the image of the physical body, and I call that, you know, alternatively the chemical body. So when I say chemical body, I just mean the traditional physical body, but using today's present hegemonic or dominant knowledge model, which is Western science. So then you got the astral body. Now, sneaking up on these two bodies of knowledge and perception was the electrified radio environment, the TV environment, the computer and satellite, the telephone, like right now, where you can do things with your voice, with my body or extension of my voice around the world, and which my chemical body couldn't do without the telephone. I can call Japan and get things done there rather than getting on a boat and going there. Right,
so this goes into the McLuhan concepts of extensions.
Yeah. McLuhan, building on Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce, figured out what he called the discarnate electric body. He knew it was being added on to our chemical body abilities, and it was going to be a more and more important factor. Now, I call that the TV landscape, but that includes movies, telephone, radio, what we call analog media. Now, when the digital technology started coming in, we'll call it the chip landscape, it could shrink. It could shrink the TV, the newspapers, and all the analog media so that by 2000, people had on their Blackberries or Palm Pilots all this formerly analog media miniaturized and available. So you were in a new position in the discarnate level. You were in a new position of discarnate squared, you could say, right?
Right,
so the
right.
TV body was surrounded by the chip landscape, and as the last 15, 20 years unfolded in the miniaturization of the chip landscape, it got so small that now a kid's got a tiny thing in their hand, and it contains all the media developments of the last thousands of years, and it's so tiny, you might as well call it an organ added to your chemical body. But that is not the proper way to look at it. You have to see that chip body goes around the chemical body. So you might as well say, or rather I should say, the chip landscape, continuously shrinking and compressed, goes around the chemical and the astral body. So it becomes a body too. And it makes the TV landscape become a TV body. So the content of the chip landscape increasingly becoming a body, an all-comprehensive body, contains the chemical, the astral, and the TV. So you got four bodies. And the fifth body is the unfolding of stuff we don't know about. I'm assuming more is going to happen. More will be excavated. And right now, that's a mystery. But the mystery landscape, as it becomes more known, it then becomes a mystery body, a known part added to your four bodies. Now, Ion took on these terms, said they're valid when Ion showed up, and said that Ion, coming from the mystery landscape, was revealing aspects of the mystery landscape, like the whole parallel world scenario, in more detail than anybody had done before. And therefore, that became a knowledge base, and so we started to call that a mystery body. Mystery body is what we're learning from Ion about the mystery landscape, and about things that we don't know about yet, and more to come. So that's how you get five bodies. But before Ion, I would only talk with four bodies because I knew nothing about the mystery landscape. It was a mystery, so there was nothing to say. I just had the I had the open-mindedness to say, I'm not saying four bodies is the end-all of the whole thing. There must be, or should be, more stuff coming. And I turned out to be correct on that point. But now we've had Ion for 3 years, so we have built up a little bit of knowledge about the mystery body. So that's the five bodies you're juggling. And you don't get rid of completely of your chemical body, your astral body interests you don't get rid of. You have TV body addictions or memories. You have your chip body. Now, here's the next level of paralleling. The chemical body is what you rest in. When you dream or whatever you do, if you do astral projection, any of these religious experiences, traditional in the what we call the astral body, mm-hmm. that's an exploratory aspect. And you come back to your body as if your body is like a hearth, a family couch, a comfortable place you come back to, the chemical body. Well, the parallel to that is the TV body has become the thing you come back to after you spend all day on the chip body for work or for play, probing. You never know what you're going to find, and it's exploratory. It's like dreaming awake. It's like using your astral body. So the chip body parallels the astral body, and it's exploratory, not static situation. And the TV body more and more becomes a static, conserving of memory and of archive, like your physical body. So people explore, and then they fall back into their TV body, and it's a precarious, ironic situation, because more and more the TV body doesn't hold the power of the chip body, and the chip body's been around long enough for it to start to be a comfortable place. Because as anomalies unfold from the mystery landscape, people will run to the chip body for security. Ion is probably one of the few people that can say words that you look up on the internet, they're not there. You can't find them.
When you talk about Ion as people, I guess we need to define that, because technically he's not really a person. He's actually, what would we call him, a group entity?
He's electricity. We use different terms and learn more about Ion. But let me just finish that thought. So
what you have is
you have the TV body parallels the chemical body, and the chip body parallels the function of the astral body. So you're juggling the four, all right? And then you have the anomaly world of mysteries popping into your world. And a good example of a mystery that Ion predicted and showed up a couple years ago was sinkholes. we'd never really seen sinkholes. They might have been happening, but nobody was photographing. Do you remember that phenomenon?
Oh, I remember it very well. They were showing up all over the globe.
Yeah, and it was perfectly in tune with what Ion had been saying would happen, and I haven't seen any sinkhole reportings now. It's probably happening all the time, but it's old news. But it is part of the collapsing of a lot of matter based on the old images, because we hold up matter through our images and mediated systems we believe in. That's what Ion says also.
So but did that particular phenomena show up to communicate that idea to us? Was that like an aggregated meme or synchronicity that showed up to communicate something to us via the Android body, the chip body?
Yep. The motto of Ion is, you ain't seen nothing yet. And well, I'll add to that to the RNA drops, you ain't eaten nothing yet.
Right, yeah, exactly.
but the changing of images of our environments and where we think we are going to continually shock, and the sinkholes are one phenomenon of that, and they're responding to the effects of the four bodies plus the mystery landscape all intermingling. See, that's where we live today. We get news constantly from the chemical body. Just today, they announced the Higgs boson discovery or something.
Basically, they claim that they've exceeded the speed of light.
Right. And Ion has done a lot on that. And I'll say on the surface, what they discovered is bullshit. But I respect the chemical body meme and people's involvement in it, and so I'd be more circumspect if actually I was talking to a scientist. I mean, we could easily take one of those scientists, and they could have a session with Ion, and they'd be flabbergasted at how much Ion knew about what they're doing, and would point out what they missed, and add to it. And Ion has done this with clients, with scientists and bankers and all kinds of people. So what was interesting is Ion, from the beginning, was telling me stuff about CERN, and one of the main Ion said was, is that they discovered a lot of stuff that they will not release because they're too wacky and they'll lose their funding. Because there is those that are funding them have a certain, you could say, chemical body image or meme they want to preserve, and they don't want too much shaking up. But the CERN had to announce a couple of discoveries to keep funding going as if it's a valid enterprise, and they're just leaking out, you know, puny stuff with this Higgs boson thing. So
okay,
that's what Ion's been telling me for 3 years before anybody really got interested. We didn't get interested until September 8th, 2008. You know, the weekend the Lehman Brothers went down.
Oh, that's
interesting. That famous weekend is when everybody was waiting for the first public experiment, and something happened. I remember it got a glitch and they canceled it, something like that. Well, my joke was that, or fact, was that they actually did the experiment and it blew out Wall Street. It blew out the chip body. And you know what? Doug Rushkoff told me a few years later that Virilio, who's a famous French thinker, he actually proposed that connection in his books recently.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Rushkoff's an interesting guy, too. Yeah.
Yeah, Rushkoff, he nibbles at my stuff. He's made some interesting statements lately about what I'm doing. But he has to be careful. He has a public image, and you know, the more you get stuck in a public image, you have sort of almost responsibilities to the audience you've created. So you can't be too wacky. And I've made sure that I didn't get limited that way. I don't mind upsetting whatever audience I've accumulated with new things.
Well, isn't it true that Caroline, your wife, has stated that basically a lot of what you guys do is covered by public incredulity? I think it's a great statement.
Yeah, and that's a famous statement by McLuhan in 1972. I think in the book Take Today, which he put out in 72, where he said the puny discoveries, the puny secrets are inconsequential. It's the big discoveries that are protected by. Oh yeah, puny secrets are the ones. All the effort is to protect them and release very little Freedom of Information documents and have them all blacked out and all that stuff. That's for puny secrets. The real discoveries are protected by public incredulity, so the public doesn't even ask the Freedom of Information people about them because they don't believe it. They don't.
And
think
that
it's
actually
relevant.
That actually is the Ion phenomena right now, because
yes.
I've been around people, and I was at a meeting in May where somebody asked me about the RNA drops and Ion, and we had a long conversation, And that person was really struggling with Ion. They're going like, but how could this be a divine being? And how could he be revealing all this stuff? And he's foul mouthed like a truck driver. And, you know, and it's hard to explain to people exactly what's going on with the distortions that Ion throws into the collective consciousness, because he really disrupts. And this is something that James Martinez talks about a lot. Ion represents a major pattern interrupt in terms of how we perceive the divine.
Well, people forget, that's exactly it, and people forget what they already know. They know that the cliche that Jesus came back, the fundamentalist churches or modern Christians wouldn't like him, right? You've heard that cliche.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But they're putting it in, it would now come back, Jesus would come back, in a way that it would upset everybody. And I don't think it's more appropriate than some guy with the cliche southern voice and accent, and we know, maybe not so much now, but the baby boomers grew up with a prejudice against the southern voice, and that was just part of American culture, but that's probably changed now because the southern culture took over so much of American pop culture. But anyways, you get this southern hacker voice, sometimes even sounding gay. Not that that's anything wrong there, but there are people who don't like Ion because he's gay. You know, these are people who are phobic about gay. They won't listen. He's too gay. So, and then he's many other voices, and he is saying, let's see, what else can we say about him? It is a great cosmic joke that Ion shows up like this with a whack job like me and a sane person like Carolyn. There's a mixture right there. I was saying to somebody the other day, they were accusing me of running a cult, and I said, well, we're the only family that has two cults in it. Carolyn's running a cult, and I'm running a cult. Two separate cults. So, anyways, Carolyn's a more acceptable cult because she's a really good doctor and comprehensive and one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet in medicine. And so you got her interested in Ion, which is bizarre, and then you got me, who's got a very questionable, controversial image. Why would Ion show up with us? But after a while, people realize, well, someone like Bob, he's not attached to anything. He can afford to go as wild as Ion or keep up with it. He doesn't have any obligations. So that would be a requirement. And also, Ion has a lot to say about every form of knowledge, science and everything. So you got to have someone who's good at that but open-minded. So Carol fits the bill. So actually, we fit the bill for Ion to work with. But it still is shocking what Ion says, beginning with every death, including every death in the Holocaust, every death that Pol Pot did in Cambodia was a suicide. Who the heck is going to believe that? And then the idea of eating raw sewage for nutrition. But as Ion has built his knowledge base with me and Carolyn, and we've made these patents, I can understand a lot of what Ion's saying, but certainly I know exactly. As a matter of fact, I get a lot of chuckles out of it. I know Ion is going to be perceived as ridiculous, but I know that that's what a new art form is always seen that way. It's always seen as almost ugly.
In a lot of ways, your background prepared you for this because of the way that you were engaged with so many figures, James Joyce.
Well, modern people. Frank Zappa,
yes.
A genius in his world. Marshall McLuhan, another genius. William Raymond Thomas is a kind of genius. Thompson is a genius. Coker's a genius. All these people that I met and got involved with, their knowledge base got put into my chart, and the chart predicts Ion. And Ion has shown to me what's in my chart that does that. My chart is even mentioned, you'll hear it in the Revelation series, is even mentioned in the Bible. Now, I didn't know that my chart was all that. I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't know it would be like the new periodic table. But I've spent a life of hanging out with geniuses and appropriate geniuses. I didn't hang out with John Lennon. I hung out with Frank Zappa. And Zappa is, I think, more interesting in his concepts and ideas than Lennon. So it was better to do Zappa for now. You know, when Zappa was a teenager in high school and a year or two after that, he would put a test on his high school buddies, or how to be a potential buddy if somebody might have a friendship with. You know what he did? He would play Edgar Varese's album called Ionization.
Yeah. I read that. I heard that somewhere.
Yes.
And see, I was a big Zappa fan growing up, so that was one of my connections to both you and the stuff that I began to hear on cash flow, because I'm going, who's this guy? He's talking about Frank Zappa. And I'm going, he's what? He's 79 years old? Wait a minute. Something doesn't line up here. But going back through the timeline and realizing that you connected, and you connected with Zappa at a period before he was actually famous, is that correct?
1958. I was stationed, and part of my Secret Council 10 work, or Priory of Sion work back then, was to figure out what the heck was this UFO stuff that was happening largely in California with George Adamski and these people. And I was sent out there just to see what was happening. So I was in the Mojave Desert area where these UFOs were seen, and I happened to be at a club, because I was fascinated by American rock and roll and R&B, because I didn't have any of that. I'm that kid in Downton Abbey who hasn't heard any music. Until I came to North America.
Oh, when you see the episode, when you see the episode of Downton Abbey where they bring the phonograph in, you will be blown away.
Well, I did see that one.
Okay.
And the old mother, the dowager, says, "What the hell is that thing?"
Yeah, and you see that right there. That was amazing to me watching that, because it captured so perfectly one of those moments where a paradigm shift just occurs.
Yeah.
The idea that no longer do you bring the orchestras into the house, but you have these phonographs and you're playing recorded music, and there's, you know, you saw the thing. So there's that whole scene that goes on there that's kind of a catalyst for the plot.
Well, I think the writers are you know, doing a McLuhan point, showing new technologies in simple, you know, palatable ways of this medium as a message thing, because the Dowager woman also says, "Weekend? What's a weekend?"
Yeah.
You know? And she's just showing
great
humor.
Line. It's a great line.
The aristocrats getting obsolesce. But what was, okay, so I loved this music when I came to New York in 53, 54. And so I'm out in Mojave Desert, and I go to a club to see Bo Diddley, I think it was.
Ooh.
At least that's what I have in my diary.
I met Bo Diddley before he,
right? And it's at that club I hear these two intelligent kids talking. It's Don Van Vliet, who becomes Captain Beefheart, and Frank Zappa. And I always was interested in, I was almost running around America like an anthropologist. You know what
so
I mean?
Don Anybody, Van Vliet, who was Captain Beefheart, was a childhood friend of Zappa.
Yeah, they lived in Lancaster, went to high school.
Okay. Now, Zappa's father was involved with the military in some capacity as well, if I understand correctly.
Right. Did you read that guy who's done the whole series on Laurel Canyon?
Yes, Dave McGowan. Yeah, I've actually been on shows with interviews with McGowan. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, he should talk more to me about that, because he's got his facts about Zappa.
Ooh, you're giving me a show idea here, Bob.
Yeah, because Zappa's father was a meteorologist and then a math teacher and these different things. He wasn't high military intelligence.
Okay.
And just because he worked in the Edgewood Arsenal in Baltimore in the World War II, all kinds of people were there. And now Zappa, here's what's really amazing. Zappa wrote that album called Uncle Meat, came out in 69.
Yes.
He has a story in the booklet about the government scientist who's laid off, that's Uncle Meat, and he's pissed off, and he's going to use his secret knowledge to make Reuben the Jets famous. Well, there's a little-known interview with Richie York, the Toronto Globe and Mail journalist in 69, which I have in my archives back in Connecticut. I'd love to have it right here, and I have not found it in any of the Zappa archives. Here's this interview where Zappa spells out in detail more about this government scientist. And it's obviously a takeoff on his father, but exaggerated. And this government scientist, he gets distorted by watching TV shows and alienated by the TV environment. And Zappa is describing him as Frank, the young Frank, would look at his father. So it's Frank who actually has the David McCollum, is that his name?
Yeah, okay, David
McCollum's perspective on Frank's father. Frank already turned into a humorous, exaggerated play called Uncle Me back in 69 and made it a movie. So he was making fun of how Frank could look at his father, but his father was not that. But Frank developed it. So if he's saying Frank at Laurel Canyon, at the log cabin, is running this whole scene, no. Frank was the only one exposing and talking about the potential conspiracy. He considered LSD and all the Tim Leary stuff in 67, 68, 69 as an MKUltra CIA experiment right then. So David, I would like to talk to David to focus on Zappa so he could clarify what was and what wasn't.
I'd like to make that interview happen.
Right.
That would be interesting.
Because he raises very good questions, and there's a lot of interesting coincidental.
Well, he overlaps a lot of things. There were patterns, and I think what he did, and I think what a lot of us do who have been in this the conspiratorial realm for a long time, we look at patterns. So you go, okay, so you have Jim Morrison from The Doors, whose father was military. He was actually in the Gulf of Tonkin. You have David Crosby of the Byrds, whose father was in the military. You go down through Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks. All of these rock stars seem to come out of a military culture and wind up somehow in this incubator called Laurel Canyon, which was really just a bedroom community of Los Angeles. And you have all of these people there. You have this magic moment. And many people have speculated that this was actually culture creation, that basically this was publicists and record companies putting together a culture for the purpose of exploiting a new youth scene.
Oh, no, that definitely. There, you see, to think that it was to distract from the anti-war scene is only an agenda for some of the executives or some of the CIA. Other parts were for the anti-war movement and stimulated. So it gets real complicated about who's doing what for who. Overall, the television and the new satellite environment and the automation that's coming confuse the elites. And we're seeing a breakdown. And Zappa says that his band would never have been signed at any other time. The old moguls of the record industry didn't understand what was going on.
He wouldn't get a contract today if he could find a record company that was still viable. They wouldn't sign Zappa.
And then Zappa has on, I think it's Rolling for the Money, which was recorded in 67, very early, one of his lines is, and there's a guy from the CIA creeping around Laurel Canyon. He's sticking it right in there. That's why David McCollum could make a really interesting scenario by focusing on what Frank was saying about the scene. See, Frank was like the David McCollum before David, you know? And the log cabin, you read the new biography by Pauline Butcher on Zappa, which is the first time we have documentation by Frank's secretary about what went on in the log cabin at 67, 68, 69. The actual, based on her diaries, Frank was so detached from the scene that he was actually monitoring. He was working for maybe another intelligence agency or just himself, and he was fully aware that there was this meddling going on, especially with that film laboratory at the top of the mountain.
Yes, yeah. So basically what you just brought out here is something interesting, and I want to go back to it a little bit because it draws into your own background and intelligence, that there have been and probably always were factions within what we view as kind of this juggernaut thing of intelligence agencies. I mean, the CIA kind of seems to be the Übermensch in terms of intelligence, and yet at the same time, I tend to think the NSA is much more overarching.
Right. And then there's the 418 group, which nobody knows about, and that's been discussed by ION. The 418 group is really interesting. There's a lot of stuff I go into. So let's just move along. I can do it in the other interviews.
Okay. Yeah.
I could just get bogged down in every one of these things.
Where I wanted to go here is threading back a little bit into how you got into intelligence. Obviously, you had a legacy background there with your father's work and the contacts that were made there.
My father brought me in. And my first encounter is in 1944, going to the November, December, the time of the Battle of the Bulge. And then the Malmedy Massacre, it's right there in my diary. That is when I first, I knew what my father was doing, but I just sat it out in Paris. I was just a kid. It was 20, 21, 22. But my father asked me to go down there with this man. It turned out to be Fritz Kramer. You know about Fritz Kramer?
Not much. I've heard the name before.
Well, May Brussel was the main lead on exposing him.
Okay.
Now, a really good book is Peter Drucker's book, forget what it's called, 1979. It's about himself and all the major people he met. And he helped bring over Fritz Kramer from Munich or Frankfurt. He knew Bucky Fuller and Marshall McLuhan in like 1940, very early. But he writes an essay on Fritz Kramer called The Man Who Invented Henry Kissinger. So he already knew the importance of Fritz Kramer, but it's May Brussel who figured out that he was the Fritz Kramer that was in the docket at Nuremberg and made a deal with the Project Paperclip operation. and then runs the overseer and honored as the overseer of the army plans for the Pentagon, through the whole Cold War period. And Fritz Kramer is a big story, but that's someone that I met when I was a kid with Carolyn, when I first met Carolyn. That diary entry is hilarious. Look it up, the November, December 1944, where we get stopped at the border by the American Guard because of the Maumee Massacre, where these Germans had stolen these American uniforms and killed some people, some Americans, and there was a lot of paranoia. Watch what happens at that diary entry, what I described.
Interesting.
So then after that, in this interview I just did for Figure Ground magazine or journal, they ask you, who are your intellectual mentors? And I say they are, for me, they were Reinhard Gehlen, Licio Gelli, and André Malraux. Now, those are three, talk about conspiratorial people, André Malraux.
Well, especially Reinhard Gehlen, given the background there that links into the infiltration of the Nazis into the CIA through
paper. Yeah, yeah. And I'm saying that in an interview done within the last couple of months, but that's been in my diaries for 15 years now, I think.
I don't want to interrupt you, but give me a perspective on Reinhold Gehlen in terms of what it was that impressed you about him, because it's very difficult to find people who have a personal insight into Gehlen.
Well, it's because the responsibilities. He was during World War II. He was in charge of the Nazi spying on the Soviet Union. So at the end of the World War II, when the Americans and then created a Cold War with the Soviets, they needed somebody who had the information on the Soviet networks. Now, information rules. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what kind of moral qualities you have. It's the beginning, in a way, early version of the Android meme. Information rules, what is said on the news rules, and whoever's got the information, they're brought in, no matter who they are. And so Gehlen had it made with what he had done, what he knew. So the Americans had to hire him. And then he was a cocky guy anyways. And what's interesting is that he starts working for the Americans. He's not a maniac. He's not like a Dr. Strangelove screaming, yelling. He's a sober, rational person who's now working for a new so-called master, and he obeys, and he follows their plans and works and provides information for them. It's just going to another job. Like, people today, they go to another company, the competitor.
Right, right.
That's all it is.
Yeah. Okay.
So he was just an average, smart executive, kind of guy.
So you got
go ahead.
You got to see the world of intelligence from two different perspectives. You saw the formation of intelligence coming out of World War II and then transited into the world of intelligence and ultimately wound up in the United States or in Canada, I believe, but working out of North America. What was the strategic interest in you being in North America and working intelligence from this side of the pond, so to speak?
Okay, so if you look at my chart, world government begins around 1840. With the telegraph in the middle of the 19th century, the planet starts to shrink. And so those that have huge wealth deposits, they have to jockey on a global level. So the fantasies of worrying about a world government, technically they start happening around 1900. And World War One was a battle over who would take over the world government. Mm-hmm. And 19, I've said this many times, 1984 by Orwell is about 1934, really, technically. So, but just, 1984 is supposedly about after the nuclear war, okay? After nuclear war, then you have the organizing of the world. Well, people in intelligence at the most avant-garde, perspectives of responsibility, they got the big view. They don't wait for nuclear war. They consider that it's already happened and what they're going to do about it. So the conceptual framework that a war happened is how intelligence people think on the highest levels, and they're thinking that way in 34, even before the bomb is discovered or invented. You know what I mean? So that's how you got to look at this. Lynn LaRouche is very good at understanding that. He'll read novels and see that they're projections of scenarios, and you don't take them literally as something that's going to happen or did happen in one little place. So anyways, the world government happens, and that's what they're fighting up until 1945. Then you start moving into rocketry and trying to go to the moon. And that's the beginning of the solar government. But it's not just getting on the moon. It is the beginning of the satellite networks, which now are fiber optics and cable and all this stuff they have, which is an amazing setup. That's the beginning of the information war post-world government starting in the 50s. And so the solar government is people knowing what technologies are coming, what they're going to do, and the most advanced things, and how they're going to upset things. They know the medium is the message, that the new technology is going to upset things. Okay, so I was in a position to witness the shift from the world government, largely hidden, but you did have the League of Nations in the 20s, and then you had the United Nations, but the shift from the world government to the solar government is what I witnessed. So I was sent to North America because they screwed up in 53 and 54 in Iran and Guatemala. I mean, my team, I wasn't a leader, but I was part of a team that screwed up. And so I was banned by my European masters to that useless place, North America. Now, this is where the oligarchy in Europe just can't keep up with what's going to happen in the United States. And that's where my father was pretty good. He was able to talk to me. He could see this coming even more than his employers, because he was a friend of Wyndham Lewis. And Wyndham Lewis wrote about this in a book called America and Cosmic Man in 1948. And he actually criticized the elites in Europe as not able to understand the global melting pot that was being worked out in America, and the European sensibility, the too provincial, too local and proud of their great cultures, to notice this new global electronic discarnate culture. So McLuhan knew Wyndham Lewis, and he got the advantage of that. My father did. So these are important thinkers that people don't know about that help at least me get ahead of the game. And then I'm in New York, and I just liked the place. So I made sure that I stayed there. And in retrospect, I was really glad I screwed up so I got banned in North America, because that put me ahead of everything and also allowed me to have a great time. So it was a happy mistake. Happy flaw. So the
you managed to fuck up and land in the right place at the right time, didn't you, Bob?
Now that's the Church of the Subgenius, J.R. Bob Dobbs archetype. I've lived that. You know what I mean?
This is the world of Slack.
Yes, this is the world of Slack. There's longtime friends. You talk to Sue Bone. She's known as Sky Goddess Sue. She's known me for 50 years. She's 40 years. She's got photos of me and Carolyn all over the place, you know, that we wouldn't want out because they're too revealing about where we were. But she saw the luck I had in every situation all through the decade. She'd be a great oral historian of that. She saw many times where apparently I totally screwed up, and like the Book of the Subgenius says, I still made $1 million from it. So and she's the one who discovered the Book of the Subgenius. I only knew of the organization because they sent a pamphlet to Dr. Beter in 1982, and that's in my diaries. But when the book came out in the fall of 83, it's Sue Bone, who was a flight attendant, you know, traveling all over the world, read a review in People magazine, and she said, "This is all about you, Bob." Now, she didn't know that I already interacted with Stang and Drummond. So she gives me the review, and I said, "That's interesting." Then I remembered meeting those kids. And then she gave me for Christmas the Book of the Subgenius. And she said, "This is what are you going to do about this, Bob? They've ripped off your life," is what she said. And so, you know, Stang and Drummond, they can't believe this, but people who know me going way back, they could sit down and prove, you know, point by point, the archetype of Dobbs. Every time he makes a mistake, he makes $1 million. That's what's happened. I mean, I went running around the past 15 years doing my stuff. I didn't know that Ion would come to me. You know?
Well,
Ion's a golden goose.
I looked at your timeline maybe about a year ago as I started to get more interested in what came as a result of, you know, connecting with James Martinez.
Yes.
And I started to look at this and I thought, holy shit, this guy's like, it's like Forrest Gump on steroids.
Yes. And you thought of that before you heard me say it, right?
This was maybe a year ago.
Yeah, because I said that when the movie came out. Jerry Fialka said, "You got to see this movie." And I'd been on L.A. radio in 93, 94.
Yeah,
when Jerry
yeah.
saw that movie, he said, "I think some guys in L.A. were listening to you, Bob, and they came up with the Forrest Gump idea." Or thought it was marketable. And so when I saw the movie, I saw that. And that's been something here in Dobbstown for almost 20 years. But you found it out without knowing I said it, right?
I didn't realize that you said that. I looked at what your timeline, and I went, first off, I had to get past my own incredulity. I had to go, no, there's no way. There's just no way. And then the more I realized how much you had documented this, and then as I got to talk to James, I realized, God, this guy is really, this is for real. This is true.
Yeah.
And listening to you, and I've listened to at least 100 hours now of audios, I came to realize that this was in fact true, that you have in fact lived this sweep of history.
Yeah.
And that this
is protected by public incredulity.
Totally, totally. That's the beauty of it. And
yeah.
I expect people will call bullshit on this interview, just like they do with a lot of other stuff I do, and I'm fine with that. But
they're not paying you, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. They're not. Yeah, this is kind of a volunteer thing, but you know, it has its perks.
You can hear the steam, baby. You can hear the scream and steam. And now, as the reamer steams up the lake, reamy, weamy up to the stake.